All right, welcome back, everyone. I'm Shannon Larratt, and you're tuned into BME Radio. Today we've got Keith Alexander on the phone with us. This may be a little bit experimental. It's the first time we've ever used the phone interface. Anyway, Keith is a former Gauntlet piercer, has his own sort of nebulous studio at this point called Modern American Body Arts, which you can find online at modernamerican.com. He's an accomplished scarification artist, a multimedia designer, rec arts, body art, oracle, and general shit disturber, as well as being a guitar player in Dee Snider's SMF. Keith, we'll start at the very beginning of the body modification for you. Your first piercing was a PA, and you had to drive 100 miles to get it?
Correct. Pat Sinatra up in Woodstock, New York. We drove 100 miles there and 100 miles back to get it, and that was back in probably 1990. And that was a lot of fun, so that's kind of what got me started. Thank you for that introduction, by the way.
Did you continue on piercing, or did you already have tattoos at that point?
I got my first tattoo when I was 13 years old. So, right. I mean, you know, being from Brooklyn, I was exposed to tattoos from, you know, both my grandfathers were tattooed and so on. I mean, Hell's Angels in New York City are a prominent force. So as soon as I was young and, you know, old enough to go into the city and saw bikers with tattoos, not that that was a reason I got tattooed, but, you know, I've seen them for years. And my first one was when I was 13, and then 16, and then like 20. And then I really stopped until, you know, relatively recently, I guess, you know, 87 or so.
If I'm remembering your tattoos right, there's a lot of Nordic influence in your tattoos?
Yeah, a lot of Nordic influence. I'm half Norwegian, so I've always been drawn to the sagas and the Eddas and runes and some of that lore. So there was a natural route for me to take when it came to designing stuff that was personal for me.
Mm-hmm. Is your pubic lettering that says, is it Freya that says?
Oh, Freya. Freya's that's the Anglo-Saxon spelling, F-R-E-Y-A. Mm-hmm. It's Freya is the goddess of love as well as the goddess of other things, but I thought it was an appropriate tattoo to have in that region.
For sure. And it sort of goes with the PA and the Frenum ladder.
Exactly.
Now, what made you decide to actually start piercing professionally?
It just happened. You know, I feel like I've told the story 1,000 times. I was getting pierced at Gauntlet fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. Dan Kopka, Lauren Pine, Mark Seichik, Brian Murphy, a whole bunch of people in the New York City shop, and I had been spending a lot of money there, going, you know, jewelry, buying every PFIQ I can get my hands on, buying jewelry for my girlfriend at the time, you know, just spending a lot of money up there and time, you know, and got to know the people. And then one day I went up, and out of nowhere, they asked to speak to me privately, the manager at the time, and I thought they were going to offer me a wholesale account, and they actually did, but that was after they offered me the job.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked if I wanted to apprentice up there, and at first I was, you know, I was pretty blown away because it meant so much to me personally. I never even considered piercing because to me it was something that, a skill that takes years to develop, and you just don't want to really. This was back in the day when it truly was something that there was an apprenticeship you had to go through. It was a real craft, and there was a craftsmanship behind it, and there was a lot in common with, like, you know, ancient guilds of knowledge being passed from one person to the next. So I just never even considered it. At the time, I was a live sound engineer. I was mixing bands in a Cajun joint, actually, or a really big dance hall called Louisiana Community. And I was doing, you know, jazz, rock, Zydeco, all kinds of great music. And that was at night, starting at about 8 p.m. going till 4 a.m. And the Gauntlet gig started at noon. So it was just a perfect opportunity. I saw the future. I mean, I didn't really see it going where it had gone now. But in retrospect, I remember asking one of my first days, asking Dan Kopka, you know, a true master piercer, somebody who really, in the end, you know, when he got out of it, he might have let a few people down. But this guy was, you know, he was the pinnacle of a piercer at the time. I asked him, where do you see this going in 10 years? And he said, Keith, one day it's going to be like freaking nail salons, and it's going to be on every corner. And lo and behold, in Manhattan, maybe not in every corner, but it's prevalent, and they're third-rate shops, and they're very much like those nail salons that you see just pop up, you know, everywhere. So he was right.
Well, I think at this point, even every small town has a piercing studio.
Well, it's one thing to have a piercing studio, and that's great. Every small town, you know, should have one. Hopefully they apply, you know, the same certain standards. But it's really heartbreaking to walk down 6th Avenue or St. Mark's Place or 8th Street in Manhattan. And, I mean, there's cigar shops that are now piercing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just, you walk in and it's just full of smoke and it's just disgusting. And it's one of the things that made me kind of back out of it now because I just, my heart is really not into it on the mass level that it used to be. I used to be very much into educating the public and I used to really feel like a great source of information. That's why I get so upset why on some of the Usenet, on the news groups, you see people asking the same questions. The information is so out there. The information wasn't out there in 1992, so it was important for the people who had the knowledge to share it. Now the information is everywhere. Some of it disinformation, some of it wrong, but the majority of it is pretty good and solid. And, you know, if you have skills, you can wade your way through the crap and find the nuggets of information. But that's why I have a reputation for, you know, breaking people's chops about asking the same old friggin' questions, because the answers are out there now. They weren't back then. There was a little bit more mystery back then.
Yeah, I think people forget, even though it was, I mean, it was only 10 years ago, but the piercing scene was really, really different at that point in time. One of the things that sort of set you apart, though, I think, from a lot of piercers at that point in time, so your generation of piercers, the vast majority of them are probably self-taught.
Right.
I mean, most of them didn't have the privilege of going
Absolutely.
Through that gauntlet,
yep.
Gauntlet circle.
Yeah, it's one thing. It's one thing to take a seminar at Gauntlet, and it's great. It's 5 days, but I mean, I did like a couple hundred navels before I was allowed to do them alone. And you know, we're talking. It was intense. I mean, there was a certain amount of not competition, but there was a lot of ball breaking by some of the people who taught me. Where, you know, if your dot was a little bit off, you had to fix it. Now, if my dot is a little off, you know, I know how to compensate. I go, okay, it looks a little to the right. I'll pierce a little to the left. I mean, I'm not rationalizing or saying that's good practice. But, you know, after these many pierces, I could kind of break the rules. But, you know, I was put through the ringer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm better for it. And I really can't complain. I'm much better for it. And I agree with you. A lot of self-taught, teaching yourself is good, and you can stumble upon.
It's a different time now, though. I mean, it may have been more appropriate back then. I think now there are...
I think it was harder back then, because you had PFIQ, Pierce for the Pro, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was it. You had a couple of things that pleasurable piercings put out that might not have been as good as the Pierce for the Pro, but their hearts were in the right place. To teach yourself then was a little harder. Now, the information, I mean, you know, you run columns that I wrote about how to pierce a female nipple and so on. The information is there now. It wasn't back then. It was very much a secret society.
Right. At the same time now, there are so many opportunities for people to apprentice. There's not really much of an excuse for someone, you know, to start experimenting on their friends.
But you're only as good as the person who teaches you. So when I
That's
hear,
true.
You know, people are telling me, oh, I apprenticed to so-and-so for 6 years. I'm like, well, you know what? He sucks. Sorry.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, it's true. 6 years of getting bad technique
exactly.
drilled into you, you know,
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm not one to say. I mean, I've been, you know, motherfucked into the ground by plenty of people for, you know, one crooked piercing or aftercare advice, like saying use, Provon as opposed to something else. I mean, so the piercing community as a whole, like among the pros, we're a bunch of assholes. You know what I mean? There's a lot of backstabbing and bullshit talk, but it's definitely a different time.
Yeah. I get asked with this, you know, BME question of the day thing constantly. The most common question probably is, how do I become a piercer?
Right.
And now what people started asking is, how much money can I make as a piercer?
Yeah, well, so, that's a natural evolution. But you have to ask yourself, why do you want to be a piercer? I mean, I get that question all the time as well, especially via email. I mean, why? Why do you want to be a piercer? And if you tell me because it's a cool gig, well, it's not. It may have been. It's just... If you're buying into a certain cachet, it's too late. I mean, you missed the tipping point. It's over. I never got into piercing art. I never considered myself cool because I was a piercer. I consider myself cool because every dream I've ever had, I've gone after. And, you know, all those types of, blue sky bullshit. But becoming a piercer, you know, it's almost a dead end now. I mean, I can say that, you know, in all seriousness, where are you going to go with it?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you want to do it? If you want to do it because you want to pierce some friends and so on, that's great. Like, there's a lot of people in the SM scene that I've counseled and given some, you know, impromptu lessons, but they would never say, you know, trained by Keith Alexander or something like that. But passing the knowledge on is very important. If the person's motivation is right, if their motivation is because it's cool, or worse yet, for the money, you know, I mean, I raised my prices to separate myself from some of the hacks in the city that were charging the same as me. So I doubled my prices, kind of get a little more like in Spinal Tap, you know, well, our audience is a little more selective.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to set myself apart that way. And then there were a few local guys that raised their prices as well, and it's like the skill level wasn't there to even justify
it.
You know, I almost feel bad charging for piercings at times. You know, it hurt. I never wanted to charge. That's one of the reasons Modern American, while I was doing well, the overhead that I insisted on keeping, as well as the decor. I mean, I spent so much money just on making that place look, smell, and feel nice. And I was giving piercings away, you know, because it's so important to me from my heart that it's hard to charge for it, and you kind of sully it when you get the money involved. So if that's your motivation from Jump Street, word go, screw you. I don't have a problem saying fuck you. You know, we don't need that type of piercer.
Mm-hmm. You've worked at a few studios as well as as having your own, the Modern American studio. What were the sort of joys and stresses of having your own? And it was truly a one-man studio, wasn't it? You a lot of the time you didn't even have any staff.
Well, I had a few. Andrea Wolf helped me. Mm-hmm. I had a guy named Nolan. I had a few people, but, you know, with all due respect to them, they saw that, it, you know, the future's not there to spend the 10 hours a day it takes answering every question and cleaning the sinks and all that. So the joys of owning your own place are to create the environment that you like. You know, there was no death by committee. My shop was a true representation of me, at least at that time. So I was able to, since I was spending 8 to 10 hours a day there, I had to make sure that it was nice for me. Mm-hmm. I had to make sure that the decor was soothing to me and that when I went home, I wasn't stressed out. Like when I was at Deviate, I would come home sometimes just like crazed because I was listening to techno music and it just, it wasn't conducive to a calm, piercing experience.
Right.
So the joy in my shop was just listening to the waterfall I had set up, listening to the music and, you know, the incense that I would burn, and that was the joy. And the joy
I don't know if you've heard Blair's interview yet. His new business that he's getting into is building waterfalls.
Building them from scratch with little rocks and
That's what he's moved into from piercing.
Right on. Yeah, it's all sculpture with the body. I mean, mm-hmm. it's all artistic. The way you do a brand and the way you follow the contour of the body or a tattoo for that matter is very simple. My first large-scale tattoo is a tattoo of water. I mean, the movement, you know, we come from water. We're made of water. It's a natural progression. Mm-hmm. That's great.
But then you ended up closing Modern American.
Right, and for the record, Blair is probably the most talented brander cutter I've ever met or seen. I mean, I met him up there with you last mm-hmm. time I was up there, but talented guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, took it one step further, inspired me. I mean, I remember leaving you guys going, wow, you know, like, I often say that the client is what makes you good. Like, I did a cutting the other day on a guy's back. It's this big lion's head. I mean, almost his whole back.
Excellent.
And I'm saying that it's not me. Almost anybody could trace a line, you know, and follow sterile procedure and biohazardous waste disposal. It's not that. It's the person sitting in front of me who had the vision and, mm-hmm. let's face it, the fortitude to sit there and go through the pain for the end result. So it's as much about the clients. But so Blair seems to have a lot of really cool clients, too.
Well, I think that's actually exactly why we're running that branding contest that he's doing right now. You know about that?
I saw it on the homepage.
Yeah. And it's basically just to find some of the best clients and bring them up here.
Yep. It's all about them. I mean, I've always said it. I hate that when people go, oh, you know, you're such a great piercer, or, you know, there's all the, you know, blue sky, you know, bullshit. It's about the person who took the ampelang. Yeah, there's a skill to doing the ampelang, absolutely. You know, I'm not going to deny it and downplay that, but come on, the person who took it, they're the one you should be congratulating. Don't even look at me. Like, when I watch other people get pierced, I don't watch the piercer's hands. I watch the person being pierced, their face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me is where it's all about. You know, that's the money shot, the person's face, that moment when the needle passes through, that, you know, you're transcending, you're breaking the veil, you know. We can go on and on with all the metaphors, whether you believe them or not. It's not about the piercer. He has to have a certain skill level, of course, but it's about the person who has the balls to accept the experience.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to play a song, and when we come back, we're going to talk a bit about how Keith got into scarification and some of the issues related to that.
Right on.
Change in my mind tonight while change.
All right, Keith, how did you move from doing piercing to doing scarification on people?
There's a guy named Darren. I really have to maybe credit him. There's a guy named Darren. Excuse me. I forget the Urban Primitive. I forget the name of his shop.
Damon.
No, it's not Damon. It's he's a guy up in New Paltz, New York, and it's a very small shop. And I really, it kills me that I can't remember his name, but great guy, right? He walks into Gauntlet one day, and he has these three scars on his face. He's a pretty tough-looking Spanish guy, hard-edged, intense-looking. He has these three scars on his face, and I'm thinking, some kind of major gang ritual or something really heavy. He's decked out in gold. I just gave him a PA with this big 10-gauge gold ring and all that. So when we're done with it, I ask him, I say, Darren, with all due respect, and if I'm out of line, please, don't tell me. Just tell me. Don't hit me. The scars on your face, they're so powerful. Where are they from? He goes, and he builds up, and he goes, when I was a kid, I was 4 years old, and I crawled underneath a fence, and this is what I got, because this chain-link fence. And just, it was such a powerful image, and when he just blew my mind with, oh, my God, I'm expecting so much more. So I don't know how that really relates, but he's the first guy I saw with the scarification that maybe might be Yorba-related, even though he's Spanish. So that got me thinking a little bit about it. And not long after that, all of a sudden, every day at Gauntlet, people were asking me, do you know any place I could get scarification? Do you know anybody who does these things? And blah, blah, blah. And I kept getting so many requests for it that I figured, I wasn't charging for it. I was like, let me practice or study a little bit about it. So I spoke briefly with Raylan Galena. I certainly, devoured Modern Primitives. I did everything I could possibly do to, get up to speed on the techniques. And I found out there wasn't really much out there.
There's still very little out there.
Very little. Al D helped me a lot with choices of blades. I mean, there are a few people. And back then, you can approach them, if you did it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got so many requests. I was like, let me try it. I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen? So I already had the biohazard mentality and the sterile field technique and so on. So I felt comfortable about breaking the skin. I just didn't necessarily feel comfortable about working on just anybody. So that, that set me up with this reputation I have now of being somewhat elitist, that if I don't like you, I won't work on you. And like this guy just emailed me the other day, and he's probably listening to this, he wanted misery, using his words, carved into his back. And I'm like, I'm not going to do it. And he goes, well, who are you to judge if it's important to me? It's like, I'm not judging you. I'm just not going to do it. I actually might have called him a loser. No, I forget. I'm sorry. But, I'm not going to be a party to that. I'm not going to carve misery in your back, because it's not about misery to me. It's about empowerment, and it's about, adornment, and it's about ritual, and it's about, all these things that, some people might poo-poo and some people buy into. I'm kind of on the line with that. Some people, I think they're full of shit, and some people, I think, really believe it. Therefore, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
I think, therefore, I am, or however you want to look at it. So I really started to choose the people I would work on carefully, and I turned down way more than I actually work on. And it's even harder than ever, like, for me to even talk to you about it, because you have to get me, like, that first couple of lines of email, And, here I am. It's not something that I ever saw myself doing. It's not something that I consider any claim to fame. It's just one other thing that I've done, in my life so far. And I really have the people to thank that I've worked on. It's not me. It's like, I don't say, oh, I have to do scarification. I don't. If I never did another cutting in my life, so be it. I don't have any problem with that. But luckily, one out of 50 people are so centered and right on that, I just want to hang out with them. It's like, we'll do the cutting, but let's hang out for a little bit. Tell me what you know. So
and there's also a shamanic element to the process, or is it sometimes the other way around, that the client is the shaman?
Well, I've always said that the client is the shaman, because they're the ones leaving their body. I mean, if you read anything about shamanism, it's always the shaman that goes to the other side to bring back the cure for whatever ails the tribe.
Right.
I've never been one to trumpet the shaman, bullshit. With all due respect to Fakir, I mean, I think what he does is worlds apart than what, most quote-unquote, self-proclaimed shaman do, because he has put his body on the line. It's I love when, people who do cutting and trumpet the shaman thing don't have a cutting.
Mm-hmm.
So, how can you even say? So, I'm a little iffy on that. I do absolutely buy into the power, and I have had experiences that have been mind-blowing. I have had experiences where I have seen things that, there have been supernatural experiences, but I don't go looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't say that they're there for everybody. I don't say we'll ever see them again. It's just this, at this point in time, this is what happened. You know, in this instance, I remember I did an upside down pentagram, something that I would normally never do, but it was on a guy that had a right side, you know, right up pentagram, whatever you want to call it, on one shoulder, and he wanted the other one branded. And we did it on Passover one night, on a Passover evening with a full moon. Mm-hmm. It was like, nothing happened, you know what I'm saying? If any night, like, the ground is going to open up and swallow me for this bloodletting ritual, this is going to be the night. And, you know, nothing happened. And then there's been times when it's just been so just spontaneous, and the earth moves.
Mm-hmm.
So you really can't go into it with one way or another, unless you're, you know, truly taking from a shamanistic approach where you do need to have the ritual leading up to it, the cleansing in the right water with all the synchronicities, the right incense facing in the right direction. I mean, all the magic hoo-ha, whether you believe it or not, needs to be in place if you really want to experiment with this. I mean, I know a lot of people don't respect what he has to say, but Genesis, P. Orridge or whatever, I mean, he's written extensively, whether it's bullshit or not, about the steps you need to take to deal with that side of that unknown, that occult aspect. But I don't, you know, really buy into it.
Well, I think that the part of Genesis's writing and Crowley's writing, there's a lot of humor mixed in with what they're trying to say, and a lot of it is made up on purpose as well.
Yeah, I agree.
On a more technical level, scarification is inherently somewhat unpredictable.
Absolutely.
Now you did a compass cutting on John Cobb's forehead.
Yeah.
What's it like doing, you know, something where you really, you know, no matter how good a job you do, you have to be a little bit unsure about how it's going to turn out. What's it like, you know, working in such a public place where anything that goes wrong will be forever scarred on this person's face?
Yeah, not only that, but on John fucking Cobb. You know what I mean? It's like, love him or hate him, I mean, that's the pinnacle of a radical extreme piercer, and, you know,
and a perfectionist.
Yeah, talk about a perfectionist. A little funny story with him too. His right eye is supposedly a little off or something.
Not a little off, a lot off.
Oh, is it? Okay,
it's non-existent. He sees nothing out of it but sort of waves of psychedelic color.
Oh,
the back of the retina is destroyed.
That's promising for his clients, but, you know, I love John. I have no problem with John.
Mm-hmm.
So I was honored that he came to me to do it when he could have gone, you know, to basically the cream of the crop in the world. He wanted me to do it. So we get it on, and I do it, and to me it looks perfect. I mean, yeah, talk about high pressure. I mean, this was his girlfriend's there, and you know, there was probably some press there, I forget, and, you know, a lot of, there were some people there. The pressure was definitely on.
If that was the point in time where he was still sort of had a, you know, all eyes were on him.
Absolutely,
still.
You know, definitely. So it was really high profile for me, at least in the piercing world, you know, amongst ourselves. So we do it, and I think it's perfect. I'm looking at it, I'm like, I'm pretty happy with this, you know. It might be simple, but it's not easy. And he goes, you know, I think it's off a little bit. I'm like, you're fucking crazy. This is perfect. Everybody else is looking at him going, John, it's perfect. It's perfect. I'm like, I don't want to touch this. He goes, let me be honest with you. I have a problem with one of my eyes, and it looks off to me. So even if it looks off to you when you fix it for me, it's going to look right to me, and ultimately that's what counts, right? I'm like, yeah, you got that right. So we kind of like opened it up a little bit more on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had an Earl that looked perfect to me, but he wasn't happy with the way it was sitting, so we just did a little scalpel, you know, tap to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was very high pressure working on John. John, even though he was a friend at the time, it's still, like I said, John Cobb, whether, you know, you're into him or not, he pushed the art further than anybody's ever pushed it. I don't give a shit what you say. I saw the video of how he does the uvula piercing, and I don't care what Mikayla has to say. I don't care what anybody else in the world has to say. It's flawless.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to drop the needle. It's impossible to drop the ring. Whether some kid in Idaho does it and dies from aspirating, swallowing the needle, whatever. John's method was flawless. The transcrotal piercing, I was one of the first people, maybe the first person he showed it to. He came up to Gauntlet one day and said, he's got a minute? I was like, yeah, what do you want to show me? Drops his pants. He's got this thick-ass piece of lucite slammed right through his scrotum. You can see he had a flashlight. He's on his rollerblades, and he shows me. And I'm like, do you mind if I ask some people to come in and see this? And, you know, we brought Denise Gianetta in and Mark Seichik and a whole bunch of people, and they walked out of there disgusted. They wanted nothing to do with this guy. And I said, John, how'd you do it? And he told me how he did it by, you know, wrapping the flashlight around it and locating the veins, moving the veins out of the way, and then suturing it, then cutting it, and then putting the lucite in and leaving the sutures in so that it healed. I mean, this guy is so well thought out. You know, it just, he's unbelievable. unbelievable. And here he is in my studio with me doing a compass cutting, you know, the symbol of perfection and navigation on his forehead, you know. So, yeah, it was pretty high pressure. We played pool one night, too, up in his old studio on Canal Street. And, you know, I learned more in that one night about piercing and him, you know, because he's a unique guy. And you really got to sit down and talk with him. And I haven't spoken to him in years, so I don't know where he's at or, you know, if he's listening, you know, what's up. But
he's just come back online, actually.
Oh, right on. That should be fun. You know, between him and Bertrand, you know, is, have a couple of people up in arms.
Yeah.
Not to mention those two in the same sentence. Sorry,
I think
John,
there's but, a world of difference.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, when it comes right down to the average punter, you know, online, it's still extreme.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
They don't really make the distinction between a guy like John and a guy like Todd. I mean, the more cerebral of us, you know, if you read a word somebody's got to say or, you know, it's a different story. But, you know, they're both extreme guys. So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. Most people look at the pictures and they don't know
whether
it's done right or done wrong or how it's thought
out.
I don't know if this is related to scarification or not. You're a pretty avid knife collector. I've been told you're this may be part of the urban legend that is you, but I've been told that your entire house is set up, so no matter where you happen to be standing, you know, there's always at least one knife stash within arm's reach.
Yeah, I'm pretty, yes.
And a few days ago, someone recounted a story to me. They were visiting your house. Late one night, an alarm is accidentally triggered. And the next thing this person knows is they're woken up, you know, by naked Keith dashing across the room in pursuit of this, you know, imaginary intruder with a huge Bowie knife.
Yeah, well, I mean, I live in Brooklyn. My neighborhood happens to be fairly nice. But my house was robbed when I was a kid, when I was very young. And we were in the house when it happened. And, you know, I think it might have traumatized me in that sense. And I'll be damned if anybody's going to take what's mine that I've worked so hard for. And, you know, not that there's that much up here to take, but I'm very territorial, you know, about my space. I mean, you have to be. I'm not a pacifist. I mean, I don't like violence. I don't like fighting. But if somebody's trying to break into my house, I'm going to die or kill them. You know, I don't want to sound, you know, like a macho asshole, but, you know, but I despise guns, you know, so it'd be real easy to get a gun and just, you know, shoot somebody. But I really, to me, that's just not the way to go. So, yeah, I've collected knives my whole life. My mother gave me my first knife. I mean, I was a Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, so I've always been outdoors and I've always used them. And, you know, I see them as tools. So, you know, if an officer ever said to me, you have any weapons on you? I'm like, no, I have a tool on. It's, you know, it's like I could kill you with a pen. Like I've seen videos, knife fighting videos, where they show you the same techniques used with a pen. And the knife fighter can kill you with a pen. I could kill you with a brick. Are we going to outlaw bricks? So knives have such an unsavory reputation, but they're some of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. I mean, read some of the knife magazines. I was just at the knife show with my friend John Luce, jluce.com. He does a lot of custom piercing jewelry and just great stuff. And now he's making knives. He's doing Damascus blades and so on. So we went to the knife show with our girlfriends up in the Crown Plaza Hotel up here in New York City, and you would not believe the level of craftsmanship. And ultimately, can it kill somebody? Yes, but, you know, it's not about that. It's a symbol of the choices we make between good and evil. When you see some of these knives, you see them, you know, you can see a prince with this knife, and you can, or the sword for that matter. I mean, you can really feel the power. I remember I had a custom blade made for me by Don Fogg and Murad Tayen. One's in Maine and the other guy's in Vermont, I believe. And when we were going through the design phase, I mean, what really sold me on commissioning these guys to make this Viking dagger was the line. And I'm actually going to do a page on my website about this particular project. He was talking about when he's done with this knife, it'll give anybody who holds it shivers up and down their spine and make the hair on their neck stand up, because it's going to bring back visions of Viking ships in the 10th century, you know, breaking the mist. And, you know, it's just like, whoa, you know, these guys, they know what I want. And lo and behold, you know, the item that they made for me, you know, unbelievable. So I don't really see it as a weapon as much as I see it as a symbolic. I could kill you with a hammer if I had to. That's not the point. You know?
I could pick up this iMac in front of me and smash someone over the head with it.
The perfect handle for it, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm into knives. It also, it ties into piercing. Not that, you know, this is a conscious thing to me, but breaking the skin. I've always said that on a microscopic level, piercing is inherently violent. The skin cells are being blown apart by a sharp object. On the microscopic level, there's some serious damage being done, you know, at the very, very small level. You look at the big picture, not that big a deal. It's just a little 14-gauge needle or whatever. But to the cell that's being blasted by that needle, it's inherently violent. So there's the whole penetration thing that might tie in with knives. But I don't use knives for scarification. And I certainly, you know, very anti-violence. But the power of a well-made art knife just incredible.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're gonna play another song, and when we come back, we'll talk to Keith about his active role in the music community.
As we become more deaf, Chinese whispers on American moans, disturbing our homes. Where's nothing to stand still, but the heart stands still, believe in something else. Than when the eagles creep, I can get no sleep. Picture me and I'll be free, as the old man would say, the best for last. Before he died, and no one cried about Polaroids and diary now. Invalid votes for the golden crown. I can't calm down, I'm begging ya, I'm begging ya, I'm begging ya, I'm begging ya. In a dream so deep, nothing to fulfill, but a heart to stand still. With an idea can wake up with a body's in trouble. A soul feels double means you got no time to waste for your most awful thing. For letting go, go girls, and the golden pearls won't say a word. But sleep, sleep, sleep. In a dream so deep, nothing to fulfill, but a heart to stand still. Stand still, but a heart stand still.
Keith, one of your side projects is playing guitar in D. Snider of Twisted Sisters, SMF. Where did you meet D, and how did that ever come about?
Well, I met D at the Gauntlet, and when I was a kid, when I was probably 15 years old, Twisted Sister was the largest cover band on the East Coast. They were drawing regularly, well, not regularly, but they would sell out like 20,000 seat arenas. They would do outdoor concerts of over 20,000 people. They would yearly sell out the Palladium. They were a huge band, but they were doing covers. They were doing Judas Priest. They were doing Ozzy, Iron Maiden, UFO. They were doing songs like that. So my first exposure to real heavy metal was Twisted Sister in the guise of a copy band. And every now and then they'd throw in one of their originals. But it was the same stage show, the same five crazy-looking transvestite, you know, sick motherfuckers, SMFs. But playing Judas Priest and so on. So D was a huge hero to me. The band itself didn't mean too much to me. The music was fun and so on, you know, cover bands. But D was a very outspoken proponent of individualism. I mean, you had to be. I mean, here's this guy playing in front of bikers like you wouldn't believe, in full-on drag. You know, not that the Dolls hadn't done it before him or anything. I mean, it had been done, but they were playing heavy music. You know, they were playing Judas Priest the Ripper, but, you know, in transvestites. So it made an impression on me that he had the balls to do that, and I had seen him jump off stage and beat the shit out of people in the crowd a few times who threw bottles at him and stuff. I remember one of his lines was, this ain't an oil painting, you know, this isn't a movie, it's not an oil painting, motherfucker, I'll come down there and kick your ass. And I did, and I saw him jump off stage and fuck people up, you know, on a regular basis. Then I saw him testify in front of Senate, him, John Denver, and Frank Zappa, and he ripped Al Gore a new asshole. I mean, he, you know, really carried himself well. And I was always impressed with him in interviews, you know, the raps he would do in between tunes on stage. He always really, really impressed me. So one day I'm in Gauntlet, you know, fixing the magazine rack, and I look behind me, and there's fucking D. And I said, D? You know? And he said, he usually says no, because he just, you know, he's a very, believe it or not, he's never done a drug in his life. He doesn't drink. He's been married 25 years. He's got four beautiful kids. I mean, he's such a family guy. It's insane. But he said, somebody told me to say yes. So he said, you know, yeah, I'm D. I was like, oh, man, you were a huge influence on me when I was a kid. And, you know, what can I do for you? So he told me about Strangeland. He said, I'm researching. This was way back, you know, before the movie. They even had a production house or, you know, whatever you call it in the movie industry, which sucks, by the way. So he asked me if he would mind if he picked my brains for a little while. So I'm like, oh, hell no. You know, so we sat down for about 2 hours and really went through it all. And I asked him if he wanted to watch a PA, only he didn't know it was a PA. I said, D, you want to watch me do a piece? He's like, sure. So we go in, it's this little, like, you know, the kid looked like he was about 18 years old, hung like a bull. And we go in the back, the kid drops his pants and jumps up on the GYN table, and D's sitting there. And I look back, and I just see D's face go ash, and he thought it was a nipple or an ear or something. So the way the couch was set, he tells the story so well, the way the couch was set, he really couldn't see what was going on. I'm about ready to do it. I say, hey, D, you want to come over and take a closer look? Watch what actually happens. And, like, his face again, his jaw just hit the floor. And, you know, D is very hetero. You know what I mean? Not that he's not anti-gay. I mean, he's not a homophobe, but he's like a guy's guy. And this was a very disturbing position for him to be in. And he couldn't say no because, you know, what are you doing here? You're going to do Strangeland, all this crazy shit, and you're afraid to watch a PA? So, you know, we do the piercing, and he sits back down, and his face is white. And, I could tell that it really affected him. But when we were done, he said, you know, he really complimented me on the technique. Going, the kid didn't even flinch. You know, and a PA, as you know, a PA is, you know, an eighth of an inch of tissue. I mean, when it's done correctly, it's less tissue than an earlobe. It's really no big deal. But it was just so hilarious to put D. Snyder in this position of you know, watching me pierce another guy's penis. And he was just upset about it. So, you know, 3 or 4 months went by of just consulting on the movie, just dealing with the issues. And, you know, I still haven't seen the movie, but I've seen some of the stills, and a lot of what I had designed for his body was really fucked up by the people who did the prosthetics and so on.
For those of you that haven't seen the movie, in it, D. Snyder plays Captain Howdy, who's a piercing-covered serial killer, sort of kills people.
He never kills anybody, understanding.
Well, then who does some pretty drastic things.
Non-consensual SM.
Yeah, in a sort of, you know,
ritualistic
yeah. Fakir-esque way.
Right.
And a bunch of people have got upset that, you know, it badly portrays, you know, people who are legitimately involved in these activities.
Yeah, and it does. But I've always said, are you going to tell me that we do not have our serial killers? That because we're tattooed and pierced, we are above, you know,
Well, I think more importantly, are you going to tell us we don't have a sense of humor and we can't do this?
Yeah, there's that too. And, you know, I want to shout out to Sean Porter for giving me the, you know, the ammunition to deal with that, because I knew I was in for some heavy flack when that came up. And Sean was like, Keith, it's a fucking movie. Mm-hmm. Hollywood, do it. Have fun. Get the money, you know, get your credit and take the money and run. So it took about 3 or 4 months before I even told him I played guitar. Because at the time, I wasn't really actively playing any heavier styles. I was doing mostly acoustic stuff. I was drumming. I was playing percussion with a reggae band. I was doing things like that. And, you know, about 4 months into it, I said, I remember the day. I still have the message sheet when he called to ask me. I told him I play guitar, so if you ever wind up doing anything again, you know, keep me in mind. Next day, he called and said, I'm thinking about putting together a Twisted Sister cover band, essentially. It would be him, obviously, but we would do all Twisted Sister material, only without Twisted Sister, and we wouldn't call it Twisted Sister. Would I be interested? I was like, fuck yeah, man, totally. So I figured out, you know, 22 songs in like 8 hours. Not that they were that hard to figure out, but I figured out all the music, and I went out. I bought a Gibson SG, and I passed the audition, and I joined the band. And I spent, you know, 3 years, you know, pretty solid on the road with them. I had a great time. Dee doesn't get enough credit for what he's about. The band was tight. We had Meza Boogie endorsements, so we were playing some really heavy gear, but playing poppier music. So it was a lot of fun playing, you know, we're not gonna take it, like really poppy stuff, but really heavy. I mean, we, you know, Pantera sound backing up this pop melody. And at the time, Dee was more into Pantera, and, you know, Phil Anselmo was a huge Twisted Sister fan, and he had really made the connection. J.J. French was managing Seven Dust. So they, you know, they still had their fingers in the pie. The Strangeland soundtrack isn't a bad album either. So we went out and really kicked the shit out of these poppy Twisted Sister tunes, and I had a blast. So I make no apologies for playing Twisted Sister music for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. But that's not really, left to your own devices, that's not really the music that you're making.
Oh, no. There's a lot. I mean, it's not easy to take three songs and write a catchy tune. It's not easy. I mean, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. My father always told me, you know, if you want that swimming pool in your backyard in the shape of a guitar, it's not going to be playing Yngwie-style metal. You know, it's going to be from a good three-chord, four-chord rock and roll tune, something people could hum, something that sums up a summer, you know, a driving tune, you know, music, highway songs, and those are the things that really touch people forever. And but no, I would not, I don't think I'm good enough to write that kind of stuff. I mean, the stuff I do is, I have such a short attention span that I can't do stuff like that. We had, Twisted Sister had one tune called I Am, I'm Me, and it's like 32 bars of E. I mean, no shit, 32 bars, gung, 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 for 32 fucking bars. But it's the melody that carries it.
Yeah.
Great words and the melody. Mm-hmm. And I remember I wrote a tune when I was a kid. My dad's a guitar player. And I wrote what I considered a song when I was a kid. And my dad looked at me and broke my heart. He goes, that's not a song. That's an accompaniment. You know, fine. You got four chords there. But what's the melody that lays on top of that? What do the people walk away humming? And I learned that from Dee. So, but no, left to my own devices, I do more trance-like electronic stuff. And, you know, left to my own devices, I'd be in a total, you know, aggressive noise rock, you know, just for a cathartic experience, you know, fuck the record companies, fuck the audience for that matter, and, you know, just go up and make as much noise as you can, rhythmically, you know, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if it's still on your webpage, but when you first started your webpage, one of the things that you had listed is the type of music a person could expect to hear if they're being pierced in your studio.
Right, on the Modern American site.
That's right.
No, that page migrated over to my personal site, but no, I don't, I don't think it's still up there because when I updated the page when I made the move to Deviate, I had no control over the music really, so.
Yeah. What, does the music playing in the background make a big difference to the person?
Huge difference. It makes a difference just on like imprinting the person with the experience. Mm-hmm. I try to appeal to all the senses. You know, a place that smells nice, a place that looks nice, a place that, you know, feels nice, just the comfort as far as the temperature goes. So those things are really important to me. And the music definitely plays a part of it to bring people's blood pressure down. I mean, there's plenty of institutes that music therapy, where they'll work with people who are recovering from illnesses or people in comas for that matter and things like that, where they'll play music for them to, you know, change their blood pressure, to change their respiration rate and all that. So I kind of took a little bit of that school of thought and applied it to my shop, and at the very least, it calmed me down.
Yeah.
So I remember when I first started piercing, I would ask my clients, well, what do you want to hear? And the majority of them would say, like, Metallica. Mm-hmm. You know, Slayer. And I love Metallica. I did security for Slayer for a couple of shows. I mean, those are bands that I like. There's no way you want me piercing you to Slayer because it just amps me up. You know, my hands might start shaking. And it's more, you know, it sounds almost selfish, but the environment is just as much for me as it is for you. And it's important that it's tranquil because I want this to be right, and it's got to be right. And without sounding melodramatic, the piercer's life is in danger because if you pierce somebody who's hepatitis positive and, you know, and you get a needle stick, it's, you know, it's not fun. So you want to be you want to have all the odds in your favor.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, choosing the right music and the right mood is one of those things.
And you said lack of control over that was part of the reason that you went away from DVA.
Yeah, I just didn't have control over the environment. When I first started, I did because they were so happy to have me and the income. But after a couple of months there, there was kind of like a change in management, and they moved a leather maker who was downstairs. They moved him upstairs, and it's like, there's no way that I could be on the same floor as a sewing machine. Piercing.
Yeah.
There's just no way. I mean, yes, they would stop when I asked them to, but I didn't even like talking to people when there was somebody sewing in the back. You know, as cool as it might be. And that was a clean shop. Don't get me wrong. It's a, you know, nobody got an inferior piercing there because they sold rubber corsets in the front of the place, but when they moved the sewing machines from downstairs up, I just had to go.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. It doesn't seem to me like it's enough. It's just not enough, baby. It's just not enough. Oh, oh, baby. My darling, I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, baby. Lord, some things I can't get used to, no matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. Oh, no, babe. Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel with everything in you? What kind of love is this that you're giving me? Is it in your kiss or just because you're sweet? Girl, all I know is every time you're here, I feel a change. Something moving, I scream your name. Look what you got to do with, darling. I can't get enough of your love, baby. Girl, I don't know why I can't get enough of your love, baby. Oh, no, baby. Girl, if I can only make you see and make you understand. Your love for me is all I need, and more than I can stand. Oh, well, babe, how can I explain all the things I feel? You've given me so much, girl, you're so unreal still. I keep loving you more and more each time. Girl, what am I gonna do? Cause you're blowing my mind. I get the same old feel every time you're here. I feel a change, something moves. I scream your name. Look what you got to do with all I got. Can't get enough of your love, baby. Yeah, I don't know why. Can't get enough of your love, baby.
At the same time as Deviate, you were working at Fox, and now you're working at Atmosphere Interactive. What you're working mainstream media right now, I guess.
Well, I mean, I guess if the web is mainstream, although we're trying to, you know, push the limits with a few of the things we're doing. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I moved to Deviate was I accepted an internship at Fox News Corp America, digital publishing Rupert Murdoch's empire, in their broadband application product development division. Which was what we were essentially doing, or not we, I mean, I was just an intern, but what those mad scientists were doing were developing applications like real-time baseball simulators. Like, if they didn't have the rights to a particular baseball game, they created the 3D software that would actually simulate the game one pitch behind it happening. These crazy applications that the bandwidth isn't even there for. Like, they're thinking 3 years down the line, mm-hmm. 4 years down the line. So it was just great to be in that environment. So that's one of the reasons I closed Modern American and moved to Deviate, because it was two blocks away from Fox. And again, very much, you know, the gauntlet parallel that I was able to work, you know, one job paying the rent, you know, during the day, and then at night go and do something, you know, that piqued my interest, only in this case it was backwards. So from Fox, when I finished the internship there, I jumped to the Brooklyn Public Library. I did some webmastering stuff over there. When that proved a little too boring for me 3 months later of doing, like, senators' press releases on the web and just real boilerplate bullshit, you know, one senator reading with, you know, eight different kids, and then they bring the congressman in and read with eight different kids, and they take their photo opportunities, and it really annoyed me. So from there, I went to a company called BlahBlah.com, and what they were was a content aggregator. I was a content manager over there, which really means just stealing content, not stealing, but, you know, aggregating content from our
partners
users.
And...
trying to be the mm-hmm. typical community portal. And that bored me rather quickly, too. So I really went on a resume sending blitz, and I got this great position as a producer at a company called Atmosphere Interactive, which is a division of BBDO, which is the world's number one and the United States' third largest advertising agency. I mean, great creative work. Like they did the Doritos commercial, Pepsi, Visa. I mean, just real. I'm anti-advertising, so like I kind of almost sold my soul by taking this job. I wouldn't have done it if they didn't just really what they pushed about the web and how they want to change communication. It wasn't just about advertising, and the agency isn't really just about advertising. So I took this position. I've been here now for a little over 3 months, having a great time. Rose rapidly through the ranks, as they say, and really, you know, got my ideas listened to. I'm pitching to a client in Belgium this week. Ideas I have for I can't even say. Like I can't. Yeah. We're doing stuff that I can't even talk about, and that to me is really exciting. And a lot of people poo-poo the web, but I see it as one day we're not even going to talk about the internet. It's just going to be there. It's just a delivery medium. Whether you want to use, it's going to be more than Usenet and more than IRC, but all those things will still be there. So it's a very exciting time for me, and it really parallels my early days at Gauntlet, being low man on the totem pole, having a lot of great ideas and grokking it and understanding it, but not having the actual experience, you know, behind me. So now I have about a year and a half of, you know, interactive production behind me, and I'm just having a great time, great mm-hmm. time.
What's the unifying interest that connects Pearsing, music, media development, and all the other things that you're doing?
Communication, dealing with people. One of the things that really made me even take the job at Fox, people say, well, why would you even take an internship? The power that the modernamerican.com site gave me, not power as in the sense of influence other people, but the power to reach people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't analyze the traffic logs, you know, as you know, but I mean, at one time when I was really into it, I was getting 50 emails a day, hundreds of emails a week. I mean, it was crazy because I had my email address on every page, and I really encouraged people to write to me, and now you got to kind of hunt to find the address on there. But the fact that I was able to touch so many people via, you know, one simple website. I mean, mm-hmm. I remember the first time the guy who did my first site, a friend of mine, Anthony, the first time he FTP'd, it was like magic to me. I'm like, you mean you just took that off this little ThinkPad and you put that on that big server over there in Nebraska? And that, you know, it's like it blew my mind. And the amount of good response and bad response. I love the hate mail. I love that shit. If you think, you know, that poorly of me and you got to put pen to paper or, you know, type me a hate mail, I mean, I love it. Keep it coming. But the fact that you're touching people is the unifying factor to me, be it music or any kind of new media, quote unquote, and the Pearsing stuff, you're touching people.
Mm-hmm. When I last interviewed you, that was probably 4 years ago, I think. It was actually the first interview that BME ever did.
Awesome. Awesome.
You told me that the Pearsing would continue to become more mainstream, like your friend at Gauntlet was telling you. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you're right, and that's happened. But at the same time, I think it's safe to say that a lot of the people who are getting pierced, you know, in their mind, they're still doing it as part of a trend.
Yeah.
You know, I think that applies to tattooing as well.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it does on a societal level when a trend, you know, an inherently temporary thing, involves a permanent act?
Well, piercing's not permanent.
But tattooing is.
Okay,
so I'm sort of mixing this all up together.
Okay, I think I really think they're two different issues. The tattoo stuff, I think, can be dangerous if it's hands, neck, or face. If you're going to, because people do look at you differently. I have two full sleeves, and every day at work, I wear a nice long sleeve shirt. Not because I think that people are going to think I'm stupid because I'm tattooed. I'm very proud of my tattoo work. It's first class work, or most of it's first class, but people get distracted very easily. So if I'm in there with short sleeves and I have the cure for cancer, people still stare at the arms and go, wow, a lot of work. Wow, did that hurt? You know, no matter what you're saying, however good it is, however, you know, poignant, potent, profound it is, people still can't go, wow, did that one hurt on your wrist? So I find that I need to cover it up. So I think tattoos...
It's like when a magician waves his one hand to distract you from
exactly.
What's really going on.
Okay, another one of my, what I loved when I was a kid. So the tattoo thing, I think you have to really be careful because it is forever if you do large scale stuff and so on. So you do have to be careful. As far as its effect on society, I think it's probably a positive one because if you just take away the people that are going to regret it 20 years from now anyway, fine. You know, if you just take those people away, the people that thought about it and got a good piece of work, that'll be with them forever, and that'll give them a reminder of this powerful time in their life. You know, I very often have concentrated on some of my tattoos in times of stress, and they reminded me about the power I had when I got it, what I was thinking about, what the imagery means, what the symbology means, what the story behind the tattoo means, you know, and all those things can really be used well. So I think on a societal level, maybe consciousness has raised a little bit to where people are playing with their bodies a little bit more. And hopefully, you know, I'm not Dr. Laura. I really couldn't tell you, you know, how society as a whole. I hope that consciousness has been raised enough now that people can play with their bodies a little bit more and realize that it's not necessarily just for criminals and deviants. Piercing, on the other hand, is a much more transient, trendy, mall chick, skate rat thing. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
But still, the skater kid that stretches his ears to half inch, which is not that uncommon.
No, but easier to fix than a sleeve.
But still surgery.
Yeah, definitely still surgery to get rid of it. But, you know, snip, snip, and it's fixed, or, you know, glue, glue. Mm-hmm. I'm not. If you're talking extreme stuff on a 15-year-old, yeah, that's not necessarily cool. Because you don't know how you're going to feel when you're my age.
Well, I agree with you, but I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad if you know, a whole bunch of 15-year-olds went out, got their faces tattooed, got everything tattooed, you know, because once a certain, I figure once a threshold is hit, you know, there's no looking at it as an oddity because it's hit a large enough percentage of society that it's just the way things are.
Yeah, but realistically, how many, you know, I don't know if 15-year-old kids should be doing anything.
Well, I agree with you that it should be adults.
But I know what you're saying. You know, you reach a certain critical mass and you don't look at it as an oddity. Absolutely. But the bottom line is we're altering something that the majority of people will never do. I mean, you'll never even reach 10% facial tattooing. You know what I mean? You just won't. I mean...
No, but I think we're approaching 10% pierced.
Oh, absolutely. I would say more than that. I mean, God, you can't walk down... I know so many lawyers, doctors, I mean, mainstream people that are pierced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just hired a senior producer. He comes in, Joe Normal, straight, you know, normal-looking guy. And, you know, after a week at the agency and he realizes we're all pretty mellow, he comes in with his earrings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's different. But society as a whole, it's impossible to really nail it down because it's just so transient and it's in flux. I hope that people don't, like, my girlfriend has a nostril piercing and she works in a hardcore, straight-edge Christian company, they think she's a freak. You know, just for that one little beautiful peridot piercing, you know, they think she's a freak in that culture. So I think we're somewhat balkanized, or I don't even know if that's the right term, but like somewhat tribal in the sense that there's always going to be us and them. I mean, it's human nature. I don't necessarily believe in duality, but, you know, there is right and wrong. So I guess I do believe in it. I don't believe in relativism. I think it's murder is wrong. Killing somebody in cold blood is wrong. You can't tell me that it's right. You just can't tell me that. You know, with shout-outs to Pook, you really can't say that to me. Killing somebody in self-defense, fine. You know, I see there are certain relative issues, but you got to take it. You can't decontextualize a 15-year-old kid with his ears being stretched. You have to put it in the context of where is he at that time. Is he with other 15-year-old kids, Lord of the Fleas on some island somewhere? Fine, that's a different story. But if he's in mainstream America trying to operate, I've always said that you can do more damage from the inside. So if you really want to be a subversive motherfucker, look normal, get in, and do your damage.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading when I was a kid, like the Hacker's Handbook or something like the cyberpunk fake book. And one of the lines in there was like, are you tattooed, pierced, branded? Well, what is your Interpol
document? I remember reading that as well.
You know, it's like you want to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. And you can't be when you're tattooed. I mean, I have a tattoo on the back of my neck. I'm known as the guy with the tattoo on the back of his neck.
The quote that I remember my father saying when I first started getting, you know, getting visible work was, if you're going to be a sociopath, don't tell everybody.
Exactly. Well, and what was that? South Park. You know, Hank Hill goes, you know what I like about people who are pierced? You just know they're wrong. You know they're wrong right away. It's a signifier.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, without, you can't decontextualize these issues. You have to take them in, you know, the context that the kid is living in. Or, I mean, I don't want to be hypocritical either, because I got my first tattoo when I was 15.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sorry, 13. So, but it was hidden. It's such a fine line, you know. And I know 15-year-old kids who are more mature than some 30-year-old men I know.
Mm-hmm.
So case-by-case basis. But do you have the depth and breadth of experience to know what symbol is good for you? Because some tribal shit looks like a magic marker, and somebody just drew on you with magic marker.
Mm-hmm.
But if at 15 you've traveled the world and Philip Liu gives you that tattoo on your inner forearm when you're in New Zealand with him, that's a different story. I mean, So you really have to, there's so much. There's no easy answers for those questions.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that as a whole, I like to think society's consciousness has been raised, that we've done enough work with the, one of the reasons I've been accused of being egotistical because all the interviews I do, it's not that. I mean, sure, there's definitely, I won't deny this, it's a pisser to see yourself on CNN or whatever, but the bottom line is we're trying to get the good information out and counteract the assholes. It kind of, it's similar to the hacker crap that's going on right now where, you know, the mobile computing magazine the other day, the violent world of hackers. Bullshit. They're a bunch of white geek kids, you know what I mean? It's not a violent world, you know? So I think that having people like myself, you know, there's a few other people that are outspoken proponents, you, that can speak with a certain clarity and, you know, intelligence about why these issues are important to us. It's very important to get that information out there well, because if not, we're just going to get slammed from all sides by the Dr. Laura's of this world.
Mm-hmm. We're pretty much running out of time here. But just to finish this off, just this morning, the New York Times printed an article calling piercing repulsive and condemned it as something that basically destroys young, promising lives.
Well, I don't know. Is it repulsive to the person who wrote that article? Yep, it's repulsive. But so is a comb-over, you know, and the author might have a comb-over. And, you know, repulsive is in the eye of the beholder. As far as ruining lives, well, maybe if, you know, you get an infection that kills you, but a navel ring's not going to ruin your life.
And you've done all right with piercings. I think I've done all right. And
yeah, exactly.
You know, BME and the online world and the offline world is full of successful people covered in piercings.
Absolutely.
Even if, you know, their lives have forced them to keep them below the belt.
That's fine. I mean, you know, you got to, like I said, you do more damage from the inside. So cover them up, and if you say what you have to say. But when you have the ear of those in power, you know, if you can really get to people. If you look normal enough to get into their office, you might be able to change their minds. If you care, if you don't give a fuck, more power to you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Keith. Before we go, we'll remind everyone. Keith can be found online at www.modernamerican.com, as well as behind the scenes in big media all over the world. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
I like the way you cross the street, cousin.
Fresh is.
Moving through the Cleveland heat, how precious. You're taking nights and all the kicks are so precious. You know I was shitting bricks, cause I ain't
fresh is.
Make me wanna. You made me make it. Oh, so mean. He skipped the 5th and Euclid Avenue. Was real precious. Hotel still ain't coming into view. How precious. It's a pity that you bruised my hip, cause I'm precious. You shouldn't let your manners slip. You're too precious. You make me wanna. Make me wanna. Make me make it. Oh, we're gonna bound and bound and bound and bound and bound the show away. Oh, we want to do it on the pavement. Oh, maybe I'm gonna have a baby. Oh, we want to do it. Oh, we do it all night. Cause I have my annual imperial, you're so Now, how are the duck and Mr. Stress both stayed? Trapped in a world that they never made. But not me, baby, I'm too pressed to have to fuck off. They made me wanna. They made me wanna. They made me make it.